I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And welcome to the podcast. My name is Howell. This is Jamie.
Yeah.
And this is Matthew Wandless.
Rip it up.
Rip it up. It's time to talk about TV. What should you watch next? What are you watching? What do we recommend? What are we trying to force feed each other and thereby potentially persuade you? And also, who's been emailing? Guys, we received an email!
Oh,
holy
yeah.
Shit.
Should I sound this excited about that? I think so.
Yes.
We're pretty.
It's historic.
It is. We're pretty open about the fact that, you know, we know that a lot of people listen to this podcast because we can see the figures, but we don't get much interaction. And so we really do love it. So much so that I sent Matthew and Jamie a screenshot of the email when this email came through. I was so excited. I said, look, guys, we did it. Not one of them replied with equal excitement. Just ignored the text.
A single tear fell from my eye.
Yeah.
I didn't want to read it. I wanted to have my reaction be live.
Thank you, Lee, for your email. Lee says, hi. You've helped us find so much good television to watch. Due to being parents and not having a life any longer, you've kept us going with nutritious televisual content. Thank you. This Is Us is quite emotional. It has made me cry practically every episode, and I'm not one for doing that, really. Having said that, your recent episode about having a rough time did move me greatly. Thank you, guys. Wish you all the best. Lee. Oh, isn't that lovely?
Fantastic.
Referring to my episode where I went into detail about my own mental health issues. And thank you, Lee.
Frame that shit.
That's right. I replied saying, thanks very much. Tell us more, Lee. What have we encouraged you to watch? He hasn't replied since.
Damn it, Lee.
But that's all right.
You know what? Actually, I blame you, Howard. You're pushing too hard.
I pushed too hard.
Yeah, you came across as desperate.
I pushed him away.
It was your first date and you blew it.
Lee,
can you send him another email and ask him what his opinions are about me? Because that's really all I'm interested in.
Specifically, Lee, on a scale of 1 to 10, how annoying is Matt Wandless? 10 being excruciating. We'll see what he says to that. So
we're probably looking at 3, maybe a 4.
Thank you, Lee. If you want to email us, we love to hear. It's just nice to hear that something we're doing here is being listened to, because as we discuss on the podcast quite a lot, we're not really sure about the old philosophy of recommendations actually working. That's why we formed the podcast in the first place, was because everyone pushes you towards stuff and you're not sure if it works. But the fact that we've actually persuaded Lee to try one or two things is fantastic. And Lee, thank you for watching This Is Us. We should check whether Matthew and Jamie have done their homework from last time, which was to watch This Is Us. Have you been as good as Lee?
No.
No.
There you go. Can't even practice what they preach. And
I thought I was waiting for Jamie to watch it, because I did say that I wasn't prepared to spend my time on it on the basis of your recommendations.
I can't believe you just stiffed me like that, Matthew.
I'm not trying to throw you under the bus. I'm just saying that I didn't say that I would watch it.
Personal injury aside, what about the recommendation from Lee? Is that enough to make you watch it?
I haven't really formed an opinion of Lee. I think you have to develop a relationship with a critic.
Once
he tells me how annoying he thinks I am, I'll, you know, if he's a sensible person and he goes to the high end of the scale.
That's right.
Then maybe I'll take a deep dive.
Lee, if you can send us an email stating which Shakespeare plays are your favourite, that will put you on a good par with Matthew, probably put you into the high end.
No, I'm terrible. Most people can quote Shakespeare from memory. I can't do anything.
How can I compare thee to a summer's day?
Can you carry on? Or
yes. Is it nobler in the mind of good fortune to... I don't know.
Yeah.
My wife
Well done.
Said to me, no, when I suggested that I do my homework too, which was to watch Russian Doll. I have also let you guys down.
Why did she say no?
What?
Oh, she's just got a bad relationship to the first 12 minutes we watched, and then unfortunately a couple of people at work said to her they weren't keen, and that's the killer, isn't it?
Can you watch it on the slide? You have to watch it with your partner, because I find ways around mine.
Yeah, I do that as well. I tend to just watch Mindhunter on loop after hours, but I am starting to do that a little bit more, stuff that I think there's no way she's ever going to bother with this. I'll do it.
Yeah, that's what I do, yeah. I set aside, I've got like a list of stuff that Lauren won't watch with me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just find hours within my... Like the Formula One. Should we talk about the Formula One recommendation?
Yeah, but let's just repeat. Russian Doll and This Is Us is still our quest. If we can do it within a month of first asking, that'll be by the time of next podcast.
All right, I will watch This Is Us. Right. And it's on Amazon Prime, isn't it?
Which it is. Good, so, it is, and the second series has just dropped as well. It really is quite superb. All right then, so what Formula One, so I haven't watched this either. Matthew recommended the Formula One documentary. It does
Formula
look...
One Drive to Survive. Let me give you a little bit of background.
All right, is it about cars?
No.
Okay.
It's about me.
Okay.
Even more interesting.
Okay.
So I used to watch Formula One with my dad when I was about 15. Until I realized, sort of a moment of clarity, that it was extremely boring. there was just cars going around the track. The cars very rarely went past each other. And one team was clearly the strongest after a couple of weeks, and they would win.
Yeah.
So I stopped watching it, and I haven't watched it since then, except maybe to glance at it, because... Formula One is a client at work, so occasionally I dabble in it.
Dropped that mic, literally, because Matthew works in a microphone company.
Hey, look, Game of Thrones are a client, but
what?
You know.
What now? What? Can you get? Why don't you get us an interview with someone who deals with the microphones on Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
That would be fascinating.
Because they're very busy people.
Oh,
let's not get sidetracked here.
This is far more interesting than your personal story. I mean, you've got connections.
Really, look, film sound recordists are very, very technical, very professional people.
You're saying they're boring.
They really don't have an awful lot of, in my experience, they don't really have an awful lot of interest in the actual films that they make.
Okay.
From our perspective, it's not going to be a good interview. But if you Google DPA microphones Game of Thrones, you'll find an article with the chief sound recordist Ronan Hill, who uses our mics on his stuff.
Wow.
Also, if you Google Formula One DPA microphones, you'll find a video about how they use them to capture the sounds of the cars.
Do you design these microphones? Are they yours?
No, they're not mine. No, it's a Danish company.
Ah, that's why you have to go to Daneland quite often.
Can we stay on the documentary, please?
Very interesting to me.
So I didn't watch Formula One for a long time, and I've just sort of discarded it as a sport. And they've made a lot of changes to the rules, and people always say to me, oh, it's much more competitive than it used to be. And I'm like, yeah, but is it? Because it's usually one of the car companies wins, like, by a country mile every year. At the moment, it's two. It's Mercedes and Ferrari. But this documentary has given me a whole new lease of life with the sport, so much so that I actively followed the qualifying and the Grand Prix at the weekend just gone. And I've set my TiVo to record the highlights for the rest of the series.
Why so?
Well, because it focuses in on the drivers. And... It's a weird thing at the moment. I don't know. You guys don't... in our conversations, you never come across particularly as sports fans. But I watch a lot of football. And the interviews with footballers are so poor that there is no point in watching them. There is literally no point in watching a footballer be interviewed, because they basically have about five stock phrases which they can say because they are media trained within an inch of their life. Because... if you let footballers talk about stuff, then they say stupid things.
Yes.
And I know it's kind of a classist and elitist thing to say, but it tends to be that the wealthier the background of the athlete, the more erudite they will be in interviews. So if you watch rugby players get interviewed or cricket players, they talk with a lot more confidence, and they will go into a bit more depth about the game, and they'll actually discuss the finer points of things.
Because often they have been to public school, or they have come from a background that is better educated.
Exactly. And also, I mean, also, there's not so much money associated with the sport. So if someone says something stupid, then it's not as massive a story as it is if a footballer says something. But
this Formula is we also used to find this about TV adventurers. Jamie and I used to interview a lot of TV adventurers, and we noticed after a while that they tended to be quite public school based. And if you go back in history, that's true. You know, the people who could afford to go and conquer the North Pole for 6 months came from a background that could afford that.
Yeah, and Formula One is a sport that is absolutely the playground of the rich and the super rich. Mm. You can't become, or at least it's very rare to become, a Formula One driver without some serious financial backing, either from your family or from an outside source. So the people who are racing these cars tend to be pretty privileged, and judging from the documentary, they are 90% psychopaths. they are totally crazy, and the interviews are so much more kind of open, and they are bitchy and slanderous, and they don't like each other even within the same team, and they are not shy about showing it. So it is much more of a soap opera than any other sport I've seen.
Wow.
There's one bit you've just reminded me, Matt, of where one driver, they just basically had a collision, two drivers, and one driver's exactly been interviewed after the race. One driver's been interviewed after the race, and the other one comes over and goes, "Oh, you're going to win the most unsportsmanlike racing driver again this year, I see." And as he's saying that, the other driver turns from the interview and goes, "Suck my balls."
Yeah. casually as well. He goes, yeah, suck my balls. Yeah.
it's ridiculous. But yeah, like that you said, was really fascinating.
Kevin Magnussen, I think. And I can't remember who the other driver
was. Hulkenberg.
Hulkenberg, was it? I thought they were on the same team.
Hulkenberg, what a name.
Well enough to know who it was, but I'm pretty sure it was Magnussen who said that. But then there's a bit where, Max Verstappen, who is the most psychopath of them all, who's, he's born in Monaco, so that tells you everything you need to know about him. And he races for Red Bull, and there's a race where one of the Force India drivers, who are a lower ranked team, drove into the back of him and smashed his car up. And afterwards, he just goes after him and is like about to have a fist fight with him. And then when he's interviewed about it later, he doesn't say, "Oh yeah, no, sorry, you know, it's unacceptable in the game," which is what you expect from a footballer. Any kind of incident like that, if you get asked about it, you go, "Yeah, no, I shouldn't have done it," and all this stuff. But you never hear anyone say, yeah, "I was so angry, I can't talk about it, because if I do, I'm probably going to headbutt someone," which is what Verstappen says. it's just nuts. And then that follows all the way through to the team managers. Like the team manager of Red Bull and the team manager of Renault have this incredible, snarky motherfucker relationship with each other. And then there's some inter-team politics with where Renault make the engines for Red Bull, and then one of the Red Bull drivers ends up going to Renault. And it's just like, it's fantastic drama.
It's like the Housewives of Orange County. It's like, there's that much drama and bitchiness going on. I can't believe the level of access the camera crew had. There's an episode that focuses on a racing driver called Roman Grosjean, and he's like constantly crashing his car. And he ends up having to see a psychologist because he's having issues with it. His mental side of the game is being affected. And there's a bit where he's had a crash during qualifying, and so they've got him mic'd up while he's in his trailer, pretty much having like a breakdown, talking about how he's not slept in days. Mm. And it's really like, wow, how did he get this all approved, and it's really like in depth. You look into this world. The footage of from the races themselves is stunning and amazing, and like it's just you're right there within it. It's incredibly like engaging in a way that I'm the same as you, Matt. I was totally turned off Formula One for a few years now, but this has kind of tweaked my interest again.
Friend of ours,
yeah, it's made me interested in the middle of the field as well, because
yeah. Yeah.
Normally, when you watch it, it's just like who's going to win. There'll be one to four drivers who are actually competitive, and yeah. that's kind of what yeah. you focus on. But now I'm all about the scrap for points between the rest of the constructors and the other drivers.
Yeah, that's what
because that's
me
the
off,
only
I
thing
think,
about the
yeah.
documentary actually is that they had almost no access to Mercedes and Ferrari.
But I think it's a good thing, isn't it? In the end, it becomes a much more fascinating world within this.
It's a bit like hearing United fans a few years ago talking about how they just win everything. It's kind of boring. It's nice to see the middle stuff, the aspirational stuff.
Yeah, but I think it is. I think it's actually good for the first season. But I hope they manage to get them signed up if they do a second one. Mm. About the current season, because it would be good to have the full roster of drivers.
Well, congratulations. Yeah, you've sold me.
Sorry.
That's great. My twin brother and a friend of ours are really into Formula One, and they'll go around the world. They'll pay a fortune just to climb through a fence and stand on a grassy knoll in some bushes to see the cars screech past. And I think it's almost as mad as I've always found football to be. And you've made me really get into it there. That sounds...
Well, have excellent. You seen the documentary Senna?
Yeah, I loved it. It's the same people, isn't it?
That's the same... Yeah. Same people involved, and like that, you don't need to really give a shit about the sport to really just enjoy the story and the drama within it. And it's genuinely, I really have enjoyed a lot of.
I mean, there's a recent kind of trend for these documentaries out there.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I've watched a couple of the All or Nothing series. I saw the one that they did with Manchester City last year,
I saw that.
Which was. Yeah. Yeah, as you say, it's kind of less fun when it's the people who win.
Mm. Who wants to see them?
But then I saw also that the first series Amazon did called All or Nothing was with an NFL team called the Arizona Cardinals, who almost won, and that really, really brilliant. I quite like American football, but I haven't watched it for a long time. But it's the way you get to know the real players and drivers in this case.
Yeah,
yeah. And also, I'd mentioned Sunderland Till I Die, which is on Netflix, which focuses on like Sunderland football team. They've been relegated to the Championship, and they made this documentary thinking that they'll probably be on a promotion push to get back in the Premier League, and it's them getting relegated again. And that's a brilliant documentary. It's more about the fans and the fans, this like real passion that Sunderland people have, and how important the football club is, and how related it's almost like a religion to these supporters. And watching their club crumble is kind of really heartbreaking at times. And that's really worth a watch as well on Netflix.
I think what TV
I've been meaning to watch that actually.
TV is realizing, certainly Netflix is giving the scope because they can take a risk on lots of stuff, but it's giving the scope to explore the same kind of narrow casting that podcasts explore. You know, so you can really focus in on one tiny aspect of something and get passionate about it. And it's so refreshing to see that happen. I came up with a wanky phrase a couple of weeks ago in the classroom, which was, which I was being slightly ironic about, but I thinking horizontally instead of vertically. So like Jamie and I are used to years in traditional media where you talk about demographics and you think sort of horizontally, you put people into boxes, you draw a line in people and you go the 35-year-old female, the 50-year-old male, and you exclude, you try and talk to them. So if you're talking to the 35-year-old female, you've got to talk about hair straighteners all the time. And what podcasts, what these documentaries have started to do particularly is think instead of those traditional boxes, they think horizontally about what's in common with everybody that comes out of this thing. So if it's mad, I don't know what it is with the Formula One, maybe it's aspiration, hope, madness, obsession,
probably stuff, more hair straighteners.
Yeah, But you can look across at that. So whether it's a documentary about Sunderland or it could be something about sheep farming, the theme is the thing that pushes you through it, and you can really explore that and find something to be obsessed at, which is the thing that's always bored me about football talk shows, is just hearing people talk stats endlessly is completely different from hearing people talk about narrative. I always find it much more interesting hearing people talk about the story. Have you seen
the experience of it rather than an analysis?
Have you seen the adverts for the new film The Keeper?
No.
It's a film about Manchester City keeper Bert Trautmann, who was a German and was came from, it was just after the war that they signed him, so this was a big, like, it's a fascinating story, and just the trailer looks awesome. It looks like it's going to be a great film. Another example of that kind of thing. But yeah, he sold me, Matt. Great. And my favourite moments of your speech there, I was taking notes, were, number one, the names, Verstappen and Hulkenberg. I mean, you've got villains' names there, which is pretty good. I also enjoyed when you say you discarded the sport. Matthew doesn't lose interest in a sport. He spits it out or discards it with disgust like a stroppy Victorian fop. And Jamie saying, and Matt saying, Jamie and I aren't into sport. Very true, Matt. I'm into football, but Jamie's not into any sport-related stuff. Doesn't even have a favourite football team.
It's unbelievable.
Do you actually into football?
No. And okay. Jamie is into something that used to be a football team. Are you still into that, Jamie?
I'm still a supporter, and I always will be, because I'm not a glory man, of Blackburn Rovers.
Are they still a football team, yeah?
Yes, Howard.
Right, right. Very good.
Goddamn right.
Well, that's me sold on Formula One. I'll be watching that. Matthew, you were critical of Alan Partridge last week. I'd like to double down on my theory about the things that they keep in his news clips. I'm certain that it's the team around in the editor that's been funny about that. That's I'm choosing to believe that. I found this latest episode the weakest, because, and this is the one where she disappears at the beginning of the episode. Did you both watch that?
No, yes, I haven't. I've only seen the first episode of this series. I haven't carried on.
It was very funny in lots of ways, but you, but what's one of the things that's really good about the series is I think she's very good. And when she left at the beginning of the episode, you kind of wanted to know what was happening with her, which sort of clouded the episode, I felt. Did you, Jamie?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it felt a bit forced at the beginning. And yeah, it was more like, it always walks this line of funny and incredibly awkward and uncomfortable, doesn't it? And this one probably teetered too much towards the awkward. Well, there's some brilliant bits again.
Yeah.
Like there's bits where he's being filmed while he's sleeping, going through dealing with his night sweats.
Oh my God.
Unbelievably funny. Like, that's the thing. There are amazing moments. There always are. And
this this is the thing why I always go on about comedies when they get into the second or third series. The same with Parks and Rec and Chuck and all of those things that I talk about that are ensemble things. The same is true of Alan Partridge, and it was true in Scissor Dial, that if it was a team of writers writing something just like a new series, you would never find that gag of pausing on Steve Coogan's face while he's while they're filming him asleep. Just like in Scissor Dial, you would never have the, you know, the camera that was stuck to the front of his face while he was in the warehouse. And it's like visual gags are allowed. Things, really inventive things come out of the team that are trying to be funny. So it becomes a physical comedy as well as just a writer's exercise. And you can only get that when a character's lived for a certain number of years, I think, when the actor can really inhabit it.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if they do come back with a second series, because that was the last episode, wasn't it? And I do wonder if they'll back with the same... one, I think so, yeah. Yeah. So I do wonder if they'll come back in the same form. Like, I would quite like him to come back with more Scissor Dial style documentary stuff. Like, I'd love his own documentary series, like a Louis Theroux-style series for Alan, because I think that... The bits that I enjoyed the most in this series were the bits where he was his little short films that he did at the side of the live content. And I'd like, but I don't know, maybe they'll come back and do another series of this. It's kind of setting up that there's going to be some kind of drama between him and his co-host again, so I don't know
if it's got to come back. I can't believe it's that short, the series. Flipping heck, British TV. Sort yourself out. But Partridge, the Scissored Isle, I was listening to an interview with Steve Coogan, and he said they actually had a deal with Sky that was for a certain number of shows he had to produce, and they realised they had one left. And they went, oh, we've got to write another. And they sort of just had fun with it and strung that together. I think it's one of the best things. I think it's my favourite thing that he's ever done.
Yeah, it's so, so good.
Funny, so funny. Have you watched that, Matt?
No.
Well, whatever you think of this new series, get on your Now TV or your whatever you can, however you can get Scissored Isle, just watch it. You'll wee yourself laughing. There's a couple of bits in it particularly that I think are just transcendent. It's so funny.
I just want to say, I didn't hate.
You just found it problematic.
What's the new called?
This time.
No, I just it just didn't. I think Jamie hit the nail on the head with it. There's too much agony in it, and I've always struggled with stuff that is based on agony because I can appreciate it, but I find it difficult to watch.
Yeah. Which is why this would be great. If this was an American TV series that had 20 episodes, you could have Alan Partridge on top and enjoying himself for five of those episodes, and you wouldn't have to have the super cringe stuff. You could just have him being overtly, you know, Uber Clarkson sexist and everything, and you could see him enjoying that for a while, which is really fun, really liberating. But yeah. Yeah, check out Scissored Isle. I think that is that. It's Alan Partridge making what he wants to make, and it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Okay.
So that's Formula One and Alan Partridge. Matthew did a poor job last week. He was supposedly recommending Love, Death and Robots. We want to give him a second shot at this because he has had sleepless nights ever since, knowing that he really just put us off it.
But you've oversold that again.
Best of luck to you.
So you've put me in a position where I'm yet again not going to do a good service.
That's right.
No, I just I listened back to what I said last week, and I think it's worth a look. Basically, is what I'm saying because I like the format, and I've watched a bit more of it, and I the stories are entirely not connected. It's basically just a little compendium of short films on the themes of love, death, and robots.
Okay.
I watched one last night, which is kind of about... It reminded me of... Did you ever see A Quiet Place?
Yes.
It reminded me a little bit of that, in that it's like farmers defending their land from aliens.
Okay.
But with these kind of robot mech suits.
Right.
And... it was really good. It was worth having a look at. But I don't have an awful lot more to say on it. Other than that, there's some very interesting animation in there, and some some amusing ideas.
Two words you've used is it interesting and compendious there.
I said compendium.
Compendium. Okay, good. Let's move on. So
check it out.
Yeah, the OA. Why am I struggling to press play on season two of the OA? Is it because the first one strung me along for so long and I wasn't entirely without cynicism of the ending, maybe? Jamie, have you continued it?
Yeah, I mean, I completely drunk the Kool-Aid with this. Mm. I loved the first series. I know a lot of people felt this one teeters on the edge instead of being uncomfortable of being very pretentious and ridiculous.
And well, I
bought into it.
You carry on in a sec. Just on that note, if you've not heard the episode of this podcast where I talked to Russell Gomer about the final episode of season one, do go and listen to it. It's very funny hearing a comic mind talk about the school shooting moment and how difficult it is to watch that when you are a bit of a cynic and have a comic mind, and modern dance saves the day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
it's totally, you can easily take the piss out of this show. It's so easy. It's so easy to be cynical.
But it was great. So carry on.
But I dived straight back into season two, and three episodes in, it's just as, on the edge of pretentiousness and ridiculousness, but I'm enjoying it. Like, it's, I don't know what it is about Britt Marling, and who's the, you know, the main creator and the main protagonist of the show, but she's just so, I really find her a fascinating actress, and I find this story really enjoyable as a journey to go on. And I know that at any moment this show could just topple over. It is like it's sort of very fragile because it's so on the edge of being completely ridiculous with this interdimensional storyline. But I'm just hoping that it stays. I'm hoping, I want it to stay good, because I know at any moment there could be just something really just blows it out of the water that is just horribly pretentious or horribly over the top that I don't buy into it anymore. So far, so good. Season 2, episode 3, I'm still loving it.
I'm approaching it in the same way that I approach changing the bed sheets, which I think is the most unpleasant job in the house. It's just such such effort. And that's kind of how I'm aware of the effort it's going to take, so I'm sort of putting it off. Do we pick up where we left off?
Yeah, you pick up. It takes a bit of time in the first episode to figure out exactly what the situation is, but
because she's gone off in an ambulance, and then she's
gone off in an ambulance, presumably to another dimension, which you'll find out whether she goes to another dimension or not.
Great. Okay. Good. Good.
All right. And from there, you're taken on that journey, wherever that journey goes. It takes off straight where it left. It's good to watch a recap. I'd recommend watching the Netflix recap before you start. We did that because we needed it. And then, you know, don't look at it as a, if you look at it as like you're trying to change your bed sheets out, you're never going to get going. You got to take it in little bite-sized chunks if you have to.
Well,
don't
the other
do a
thing
full
is
episode.
That the first series relied on such a, it wasn't a whodunit, but it was a what's going on, right? And it kept you going for so long with that question that I feel like we got an answer to what's going on. Is it now a new question? What's now going on?
Well, because by the end of the series was Prairie was trying to find her true the love.
Hang on,
of her
has Matt seen
met.
This?
Sorry,
Matt, did
you
watch
that? Yeah, I've seen the. First
okay,
series,
good.
Yeah,
go on, Jamie.
So Matt, you know that Prairie was in love with this guy Homer, and they were all trapped together in this particular environment where they were being tested on like lab rats, and she was like cast aside from this group, and it's believed that they are in another dimension now with this bad guy played by Jason Isaacs, who was like this kind of sort of mad professor. And now her journey is, her quest is to find Homer, because she's in love with Homer. So although, yeah, how there was a little bit of figuring stuff out season one, the overall goal was for her to get back to finding Homer and saving him from wherever he is with this mad professor guy. So that is where season two takes you on that
Hang
journey
on.
With Prairie.
Hang on. When did they go to another dimension?
Right. In the ambulance, Matt. What's wrong with you?
No, they haven't gone to one. In season one, they haven't gone to one. But the presumption is... you need to watch the recap, guys. The presumption is that they might have gone to another dimension. There's a possibility that they have.
I
but
see.
Why is that the presumption?
Matt, do you not have this? Do you not have a vague recollection of the school shooting thing finished? The ambulance is heading.
I remember that. So
the ambulance is heading off, and he's chasing after the ambulance. Is Homer chasing the ambulance?
It's not Homer. No, it's the weird kid. Yeah.
The weird
kid from the school.
And I seem to remember saying, "Oh, is she going off to another dimension now in the back of that ambulance? And will they stop at a McDonald's drive-through?"
Let me recap it how I remember it. So OA turns up in her hometown, having been gone for ages.
Yeah.
We find out that she's been held in this place by Jason Isaacs, Mr. Madness. Mm. And in that place, they kind of, the five or six people who are in there piece together this weird piece of modern interpretive dance
that unlocks other dimensions.
Yeah, wait, hang on a second.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's what they do, remember? No?
How does it unlock other dimensions? I remember there's some kind of machine that he keeps taking them to.
Mm.
Yeah, and for a while he's just like testing killing them because they've all had near death.
That's right. He drowns them, doesn't he?
Yes. So that, and they're having all these visions, and he's trying to work out what these visions relate to in these near death experiences. And they figure out that they are actually being transported when they go to these near death experiences to another dimension.
And that's where they learn the movements.
Yeah, and they each learn a separate.
I'm just imagining somebody. So there is definitely at least one person listening to this podcast who's never seen the OA. And when you listen to this description,
yeah, it is ludicrous. It is ludicrous, right? But just accept that by the end of season one, Jason Isaacs has pushed Britt Marling Prairie out of the group. And he's learned the movements himself, so he's going to take the other four lab rats. Yes, because he's been watching them and filming them.
Yeah.
This is in season one. And he says, "You're not going to get to go with us." And he casts her aside, and she tells her basically he's going to take the other four on another journey into another dimension. And so Prairie goes home, finds this group of misfits in her hometown and tries to teach them the movement so she can get to another dimension.
Meet me at midnight to learn modern dance.
Wow.
It's okay. So rocking. It's like Teen Wolf, basically, isn't it? I mean, it's very
similar. You probably made it sound a lot worse. It's good.
You've reminded us. So then the school shooting happens and they realise that if they all stand up and do modern dance, it will freak the shit out of the guy who's doing the shooting long enough for him to pause. What happens then?
No,
gets shot.
She gets shot.
That's right. Stop dancing.
They do the movement. She gets shot, and then she is then taken in an ambulance. And as she's in the ambulance, her soul or whatever is transported. Maybe into another dimension. You're going to find out in season two. I
think maybe it does. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Go. Give it a go. Honestly, do a recap. Give it a go.
God, I wish I'd spent.
I might do.
I wish I'd spent the last 10 minutes changing my bed sheets. No. Good.
There's nothing like it.
Good. Okay. Effort is ahead, and in terms of suspension of disbelief. This is a big one, isn't it?
Big time.
It was enjoyable, and we will pick it up at some point. There's a lot going on at the moment. I mean, Fleabag is taking up a lot of our time at the moment. Unfortunately, that's been released week by week, and we're up to date so far. But
I haven't seen this week's yet. I'm still looking forward to that.
No.
So good. And it's so good to hear Matthew's favourite Moriarty on screen again. Not at all.
How good is Andrew Scott in this series?
Oh, he's so good. And I said to Sarah, even when he gets angry, I'm amazed that even when his character gets angry, he doesn't have the Moriarty eyes. He's such a good character actor. You would think that once he went berserk.
That's how good the writing is in Fleabag compared to Sherlock.
True. Hello, Sherlock. Go on, Matt, do it.
No, I can't.
Oh, please.
No, I'm sorry. It won't be good if I do it like this. I have to think about it.
Hello, Sherlock. See, I'm doing it, and it can't be worse than that.
No, it couldn't be worse than that.
Hello, Sherlock.
That'll do, man.
It's just so good. And he's great. He's great. She's great. I mean, one thing that I will just point out... I enjoyed the fact that in one of the episodes, she talks to a woman who's getting an award for being Best Woman Award. And this is something that
it's
I often...
Kristen Scott Thomas, isn't it?
Is that who it is?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
I love that little chat, actually. That was a brilliant little duologue there.
There was a nice line in it where she says, "I hate these awards. It's not progress. It's dressed up as progress, but actually it's just..." What did she say? I mean, essentially she said vertical... whatever my stupid phrase was, it's not progress, it's siloing, I think she said something like that, and I agree with that. And this is where I get in a lot of trouble at the moment whenever there's a new movement out. For example, what's the name who writes it? Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Phoebe Waller-Bridge Number one, she is awesome. She's brilliant. She's talented. I don't know anybody better. She's one of my favourite writers of all time. So I am not for a second suggesting that she doesn't deserve the position that she's got. However, every time she's talked about, it's always about, isn't this great that there's a woman writer. She comes from an incredibly privileged background, incredibly well-educated background, and I believe, I'm not sure whether it's her relatives or certainly, I think her relatives are like executive producers at the BBC or something, and something that I'm constantly trying to talk about is privilege in general rather than just male privilege and looking across that way. And I'm really glad that I think that that line from her, that scene from her, is in part probably the reaction to the amount of times in interviews that she has to answer the question about being a woman. You know, it must become incredibly annoying, just like the director of Get Out always has to be asked a question about being a black director, and I hear in his voice a kind of, yeah, I'd like to think that I'm being interviewed for being a good director, you know. Anyway, that's my rant. Finished. Fleabag's great. Anything else to say about it?
No, I just wanted to go on for 18 episodes, really.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. If only British TV went on. But you know, you've got one writer often. In Partridge, you've got three writers. In this, you've got one. Whereas in America, you've got 20, so you can churn out.
Really? Them. Just one?
Yeah, it's just her in this. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought I heard a really nice story around Fleabag. Was the on Sunday brunch, you know, the woman who plays her sister?
Hmm.
Well, they both went to drama school together, and they said whoever made it first would give a part to her, the other one.
Oh,
and
nice.
She said that when obviously she made Fleabag, she fought for her to be a sister, and the producers were like, no, we don't want her. We want someone who's a bit more famous. And she had to fight hard to get her the role. And it's really nice, like, story of working with a friend from your school, that your drama school days, and making it. Oh, and she's nice. Really good, her sister. She's
so
really
good. It's such a tough character as well. And it's such an unusual character. I think it's a brilliant relationship they've got.
Wow. Nice. And her sister, her older sister, Isabel Waller-Bridge, writes the music for it as well. Did you know?
Lastly, should we give a little brief mention to Walking Dead? Because it's ongoing. Well, it's the finale's happened. We haven't seen it, have we? Any of us?
We haven't seen it. We've watched the one before, which is called The Calm Before. And it felt very long, that episode.
Yeah.
That was a hard episode.
Oh, yeah.
Remind me.
It ended with spoilers alert. It ended with Alpha showing them all their heads on spikes.
Oh, yes, how delightful. I like the medieval nature of this series in general, although Sarah pointed out a really good point about the hilltop. No, not hill, the kingdom, which was when they had the fair, everyone's playing lute music. And she said, all right, I get that we're supposedly, you know, this series is about going back to kind of Western time and inventing society properly and constitutions. But in this length of time, would people have really gone back to playing the lute and playing actual medieval music?
You know what? I bumped on the lute music, but I actually think that she's confusing diegetic and non-diegetic music.
Do you? Whoa. Oh, I don't think so. Yeah. I think they're playing it in situ.
I don't think the music that we heard when that was going on was actually being played in the village.
No. Well, yeah, but that would be the only time that that's happened, that you've chosen like a period piece rather than just the horror music. I don't go with you on that.
That's
one.
Not true. They have lots of music played in the show.
Do you like that? That could take you back? I don't think so.
I could be wrong.
Hang on, weren't they playing music on the stage?
They did play some music on stage, but that was just a guy and a guitar and someone else singing.
Okay, all right.
But you didn't actually hear them, so I don't. The fact that we never saw anyone playing the music makes me think that it wasn't actually playing. It makes me think that it was just... Okay.
I'll suspend my disbelief, but I stand by that as a general criticism. My only criticism of this series is sometimes it has felt like that stuff, that look where we are now in the oldie-worldie, stands out so much. For example, when Michonne gets in a horse-drawn carriage made out of a car, it's very difficult not to really notice that, to the point that you go, that's an interesting set that they've made there. And seems
I don't
to...
think I don't think I agree with you about that, because they really that they announced it in the last series when that weird woman turned up.
What's that?
And do you not remember there was a woman who turned up? It was like, it was a weird,
yeah, the weird woman who where, then disappeared. Yeah, yeah.
Who then gave them the keys to the future in exchange for some records?
Yeah,
and then fucked off. But in that, they remember they opened the book and they looked through it, and there was loads of kind of not medieval, but pre-industrial farming stuff.
And so take it back.
Yeah, I think it's fair enough, really. And like when you see things like the little water, turn. What the fuck is the word? Why can't I think of any words?
Water wheel.
Well, yeah, the water wheels were going around in Alexandria. It's like, you know, what are you going to do unless you've got a bunch of people who happen to have been engineers? Yeah,
and of
in
course,
how the hell are you going to build stuff?
And they stole that big plow from the museum
to recreate
museum.
The fridge.
Yeah,
I would have fucking no idea how to do it.
I suppose all I'm saying is that it feels like that has been that kind of, oh, look at what we're doing now, has been made enough that sometimes the pace feels, it's felt most like a horror genre at some points for me, in that way where they'll set up a couple of characters, like the old couple. So they'll start an episode with someone we've never met going, isn't it wonderful that we have such a perfect life and nothing will go wrong? And then you go into, you know, you kind of know that something's going to happen with them. I feel like they've kind of done the same thing. They've kind of made a thing of showing the turn of the century inventions, or the turn of the pre-industrial century inventions, you know.
Yeah, but I think that is just another hallmark of the show having thought about how it would work.
Which is nice.
And I respect that. But yeah, I totally get what you're saying in the sense of, like,
pace.
This whole episode was just, it was so heavily loaded with joy.
Yes.
At the start that you knew. I was saying to Hannah, I was like, good grief, the payoff at the end of this is going to be absolutely horrific.
It was like watching Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, like before they storm the castle or something, wasn't it? It was like, something's going to happen here.
I felt like we were going to lose like 6 or 7 main characters.
Yeah, and we lost Tara. Tara.
Yeah, we did lose Tara, which that was arguably the biggest one. Although I feel like Tara's lost any identity in the last couple of series. So, I was so disappointed when they killed off, I can't think of the name, the one from Nurse Jackie. No. Way back. Yeah. I can't think of the name of the character or the actress. She's really good as well. Damn it. Well, I can't remember her name. She's so funny. The one who got shot through the eye by, what's his name? Dwight. Do you remember Howell?
No. No, I don't
remember Nurse Jackie?
Zoe
from Nurse Merit Jackie.
Weaver. Oh, yeah, Merit Weaver. Yeah. Yes, I was gutted when she
went. Tara and her were together, and then she went out on a walk with Daryl.
That's right. And that's
and
where
got a fucking arrow through the eye.
Yeah, that's where the whole Negan story started, wasn't it?
It was. Mm. And then Tara, from then on, I feel like she's just been a bit...
Yeah.
And so when she died, I didn't really bother. The only one who actually really, I would feel like, oh man, about the people whose heads were on spikes was Enid,
right?
Who I've always liked. And
I have this behind the scenes view on Tara, though, which is that whenever I saw her interviewed, she was always very rock and roll. Like, she'd be misbehaving in interviews and stuff, and I started to think, this is just the last couple of years, and I started to think they're going to get rid of her. She doesn't toe the
fucking cam this one.
Yeah, she doesn't toe the line. And I started to notice that in her performance, that she was really quite confident. She'd really got into the stride of what she was doing, but became a bit expendable, which is a shame, I think, because I like the actress.
She was a really good character at the start, and I like the fact that she was from the governor's place, and, you know.
So we began this series having ended a war and kind of going, we're not going to have war anymore. I'm predicting, are you, that the final episode of the series is going to be back to war?
Maybe, I don't know. I think the final episode of this series, I reckon probably not an awful lot will happen. I think it'll be about preparing.
Well, surely not, because this episode was called The Calm Before. So it must be.
Yeah,
the storm
I don't think the storm will happen until series 9 or whatever we're on.
Interesting. I mean, surely in order for the series to continue, if there is a storm in this next episode, it can't resolve. We can't have another all-out win. Hey, great, let's move on with life. But we're certainly looking forward to some payback towards the most annoying character in history since the Bin Dippers.
Well, you know what annoyed me about this episode is Walking Dead have kind of fallen into a trap of having villains who, to borrow a phrase from The Incredibles, they have a habit of monologuing.
Yes.
Like in this episode, she specifically she got a bunch of people. She killed a load of them in a very horrible and graphic way and left one alive to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
Then caught another bunch of people and let them go as well.
Yeah, which was very useful to us, wasn't it? That she let all of them go rather than just one of them.
Yeah, because she had Daryl, mm-hmm. Carol,
mm-hmm.
Who else was there?
Farrell, Barrel, and Laurel.
That's the funniest thing you've ever said on the podcast, Owl.
Oh,
right,
thanks.
There.
Wow.
Well done. That was good.
Oh, it tickled him.
Who was in that group? There were some big hitters.
Yeah.
Carol.
And it was, you're right. It was one of these.
Michonne was there. They could have taken out the entire leadership of everyone in one fell swoop. And it would have been like, these guys are never coming back now. You send them off with your fence and you have won.
So again, the horror movie tropes that annoy me are things like that, where you go, come on, make it harder for yourself than that.
Especially in a world like this where it's so brutal.
Yeah. Yeah, surely she would have done a few of them.
Big man in the leather jacket would have wanted, who just got pushed down a fucking elevator shaft by Daryl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Surely he would have said, can I just kill that one?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, my cat's got strong opinions.
Fleabag. Yes, really good point. Well made. And we're back to that fundamental problem of a horror series, which is that you need characters to connect with, but you always need a new fresh crop. I just felt
I feel like they've always had a reason to let people go. Like the very famous Negan, bat scene.
Yeah,
it was a clear thing. It was like he was trying to just he was in his head. He was saying, "This is how I lay down the law. Mm-hmm. I put the fear of fucking God into them."
Yeah,
and then let them go and they work for me. And
if you haven't seen the Negan bat scene, it's when Negan dresses up as a bat and jumps out from under a table, scares the willies out of everybody. Sorry, I think Skype dropped out for a minute there. Carry on.
No, Skype didn't drop off. That was just.
We missed the laughter. Carry on.
I forgot. I've lost my train of thought now. We've been in a lot of situations where people have gone almost to the brink, but there's always been a fairly justifiable reason why not.
Yeah.
But this one, it just felt like here you've got all the people who are going to lead the revolt against you if you let them go in one place. You've got knives to their throats. What have you got to lose here?
I think the point was that she knew she had the leaders of the communities and she wanted them to send the message as well. She wanted them to kind of...
Why? Sadiq's already tied to a tree on beheaded mountain. Someone's going to find him eventually.
I think she kind of respects other alphas. Like, I think because she sees that she's an alpha, isn't she? She respects that there are leaders, and that those leaders should. That's the way I'm just justified.
So it was a UN. It was a UN peace talk, essentially, is what you're saying.
It was a
G6.
And the thing is, this series, whatever happens in the final episode, I've enjoyed it a lot more. It's been a really solid season. It's like it built some good foundations. I actually am really enjoying these zombie whisperers, and they are menacing in a way that I quite like.
Not her though. I mean, she annoys the hell out of me.
It's Samantha Morton. She's a very talented actress.
I don't care.
She might be doing a dodgy accent. But,
Why don't you go back and tell everybody that I'm a bad alpha?
I don't have a problem with the accent particularly, but I think the choices about... I don't like the choices particularly.
I'd like you to notice the length of her vowels. That's what annoys me. The length of her vowels. Good. I think that's it. We were going to talk about Umbrella Academy because Jamie's or Matt's watched a bit of that. Is that correct?
We can leave that for now. I've watched. Yeah,
Jamie needs his tea. All right.
Yeah.
Good. Good. Well, as good ever, stuff. Please agree, disagree. Tell us that we've changed your life on email studio@theboxsetpod.com. studio@theboxsetpod.com. Thank you all and see you in a fortnight. Bye.
See ya.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.